AutoLine After Hours is brought to you by Bridgestone, passion for excellence.
This is AutoLine After Hours with John McElroy, episode 58 for Thursday, June 3rd, 2010. Jed, move away from there. Watch AutoLine After Hours live at AutoLineDetroit.tv every Thursday at 7 p.m. Eastern Time or 2300 hours GMT. You can subscribe to this podcast for free by searching for AutoLine After Hours in the iTunes Store. We're back again Thursday night, AutoLine After Hours. And as I always start out with the auto extremist himself, Peter DeLorenzo.
Buongiorno, Gianni.
Buongiorno. And David Welch from Bloomberg Businessweek.
Always great to be here, John.
Oh, you don't have some fake accent that you can give me?
Oh, I've got no accent I can give you tonight. It's all natural.
Well, this is kind of a slow news week. I can't believe, you know, after month after month after month of me saying, man, do we have a lot to talk about. There is good things to talk about, but not as crazy in the news as it's been. But
we're hitting the summer months where things slow down a little bit.
Yeah. What'd you make of May sales? Because we got May sales.
It's just the kind of slow, hopefully sure, crawl out from the auto recession or depression that we've had.
They did dump a lot of incentives in for the Memorial Day weekend.
Yes, they did.
A lot of fleet from Ford and GM to a lot of fleet sales. So it was a completely underwhelming month.
It is amazing, though. When they do these big blowouts and you think, well, no, it doesn't matter. Wow.
It works.
But an 11.6 SAR when GM and Ford were at 36, 38% fleet, and their explanation was, well, we just got some big rental fleet orders because they're turning over the fleets. Well, that's fine, man, but the retail on the other side wasn't there. If it was really just a big month of fleet, then and you still had improving retail, then you'd have much bigger overall numbers. It's still pretty weak to me.
So how long have you been the voice of doom, David?
I'm just underwhelmed.
No, you're just saying. And it's just, you know.
It's better, but
Yeah, it's a slow, slow.
I guess I'm getting a little jaded from listening to sales calls where sales executives are crowing over the 24% sales gain over last year.
Absolutely agree with
you. Oh, yeah, no. Motors, man.
Yeah, last year was the dead zone.
Right.
So if you're up from the dead zone, yeah, high five. Why? Because you were out of business.
They had some brands, and I was looking at the luxury market. Porsche, Mercedes, or Porsche, Lincoln, and BMW were all down. That's bad.
Well, the only thing is, I don't compare anything to a year ago. You know, a year ago, Chrysler had just come out of bankruptcy. General Motors was just going into bankruptcy. And I think it skews it so much. I keep paying more attention to the month-over-month numbers. And two that really impressed me is, number one, Nissan. Nissan's putting a string of good months together here, I think.
Putting some money on the hood, though, too. They are doing pretty well.
They're on a roll, though.
I think they are, and I think Chrysler is surprised again. You know, here's 5 months in a row of increasing sales. And I know everyone says, oh, there's a bunch of fleet in it, but I keep saying, so what? They're increasing sales every month. Who would have thought they could do that?
I'm impressed if they can stay afloat until the new models come out. Then we'll see what Chrysler's really made of, if the new models really turn the needle like they're supposed to and like they're saying. You know, is the cavalry coming over the hill with Grand Cherokee and 300 and the stuff over the next few years?
There's a story in the Detroit News, a big picture of, you know, Alpha. And, you know, I couldn't for the life of me find anything in that story that was of any substance other than here we've got some pictures of Alphas. And I, maybe it was just me, but it's just like really a smoke and mirrors dissertation or something. I don't know what was going on.
It was an excuse to get a nice picture of an Alfa Romeo in the front of the business.
A red Alfa Romeo, so people will, you know.
Okay, but if you guys are cynical about sales being up, either through incentives or fleet sales, you got to read something into the fact that Toyota's looking really weak.
I think, you know, they should be worried because they've been throwing incentives on, and maybe the consumers have gotten to the point where, it's no big deal that they have incentives anymore.
I said here 2 months ago that I felt all the incentives were going to do is pull in the people who were going to buy Toyotas anyway.
Yeah.
And that they did not bring in new buyers. And as soon as they burned through the people who were going to buy anyway, I said midsummer they were going to start to run into trouble.
Yeah.
And I think we're starting to see it.
Look at Lexus sales. They had a really good month, but they had the unprecedented access program, which that was the brand name for it, and it's basically cheap lease deals and cut rate financing. And you listen to their sales call, and they're talking about how great it is. This isn't the Toyota of a couple years ago that had great months and said, and by the way, we didn't get pulled into the incentive war that all of our competitors were kicking off. And now they're celebrating good months when they've had to spend a lot of money to get there. So
you mentioned that new Lexus commercial on your show today.
Mm-hmm.
What do you think of it?
Well, wait, which show are you talking about?
Autoline Daily, John.
Autoline Daily. We didn't mention a Lexus commercial, did we?
Didn't we? I thought you mentioned the Lexus commercial with the LFA and the...
Oh, that one. The Lexus LFA ad.
Am I in the right building here? Excuse me.
I know. Jesus, I've been working on so much today.
Bueller.
I think it was a cool ad.
Yeah, it's a cool ad, but I just wonder. I mean, it's, let's face it, you know.
It's the one where they break the champagne glass.
With the LFA. I mean, let's face it. They're selling these things for, what, $375,000? They're still losing their shirt on them, and they're just figuring, yeah, let's try anything at this point. But I liked it.
I'm just saying, as a commercial, I really watched it. And it was like, okay, and now they had to hire a physicist to find the champagne glass that had the right resonance that would shatter. So it's like, hey, it's a visually arresting ad. It's interesting to me. But is it going to move the needle for Lexus?
Is the LFA going to move the needle for Lexus?
Yeah, because there's someone out there in the audience saying, how much is that a month?
No, I don't think the LFA is going to help Lexus.
I think it's the
wrong car for Lexus. Yeah. It should be a Toyota.
I think it's. I also think it's too far above what Lexus is, and it's completely different from the brand. And it's not like Maybach, where it wasn't even branded as a Mercedes, and they sort of lost that connection. I think the LFA is such a disconnect from what Lexus is.
I totally agree because, you know, while Lexus has an inferiority complex, as good as they are, as solid as their quality is, as comfortable as their cars are, they're like, we're like a wimpy guy kind of next to Audi and BMW and Mercedes. So now they're going to do this performance car to prove that we can really do it. I don't think their customers care. And I'm not sure it's going to bring in new customers to that brand.
I'd question this when Bob Carter was running Lexus and they were coming out with the GS and the IS, taking square aim at BMW and Mercedes to get better performance, better handling, and really say that we're in the same game. And he had some good logic in that boomers don't want to be seen as driving these overly comfy kind of old man's cars. But everybody was chasing BMW. Mercedes was pushing performance at the time. Cadillac, Infiniti, everyone's going to that end of the luxury spectrum. Lexus owned, quiet, comfortable, good customer
service. And there's nothing wrong with that.
There's nothing wrong with it. There's actually a lot right with it because it's worked for them and it's a unique position in the luxury market, whereas everybody else has gone sporty performance, which I happen to love, but why would you abandon a unique market position? And by the way, from an engineering standpoint, they have not been able to crack the code on really giving you that feel in a performance luxury sense. Nothing wrong with the GS and IS. They drive great, but they just don't have that panache that a BMW
that
has.
Edge to them. Is the LFA being sold as a Lexus elsewhere in the world? I can't believe that it is. It's got to be a Toyota, right?
You know, I don't know. But, you know, we should applaud these ego projects, because if we didn't have these ego projects in this business, right. Got to say, it'd be pretty dull. So, hey, yeah, they should just admit, yeah, we took a flyer at it. Now we're trying to justify it, and it's really not working. But it's pretty cool, don't you think? And I'll buy that. I'll take that. But I think you're right, David. Lexus had a positioning in the market that differentiated itself. So every time they veer into the performance arena, it's just like it just doesn't compute.
It doesn't.
You had the big comfortable car routine, so stay there.
Stay there.
It's not their strong suit, Sheldon.
But the one cool thing about the LFA is really it's kind of a test bed, I think, for a number of technologies, most importantly this carbon fiber stuff, and especially how they're weaving it together.
Well, that's
why
you do.
That's fascinating.
That's why you do right. stuff like that.
Right.
You know, to the people outside the business, they say, oh, that's a waste of money. I said, no, you have to do stuff like that. You learn so much. That's why you do it. That's why you push the envelope. That's why you go racing. Things break. You figure out stuff, and you end up building better cars.
I'm thinking if I'm Lexus and I wanted to move up above the LS and really say we can compete with Mercedes and BMW, you do something that's like a Lexus competitor to a Bentley Continental GT or something like that. It's a coupe, it's sporty, but it's still this big luxury car with serious presence that's just well above the LS, and that says we've arrived as a luxury brand instead of this super sports car that competes with Lamborghinis and Ferraris that is a complete disconnect with the brand.
Yeah, well, they won't have to wait long because the Hyundai Equus will be all over their stuff in a second. So
yeah, it will. And, Hyundai had a pretty good month, and they keep telling me it's mostly retail. So and I don't know how true that is.
I'm driving a Genesis 2.0 turbo track, they call it. Pretty decent looking, pretty decent feeling and dynamically, but how can I say this delicately? The motor is tractor-like, you know? It's just,
right.
I mean, you hammer the thing and it's just like, really? Is that all there is? And it runs out of breath at 5,000 RPM and it doesn't sound good. And it's just like, boy, this car.
It looks better than it drives.
Yeah, it's a disconnect.
It is. No, I totally agree.
It's a real disconnect.
And I don't know, is it a manual, the one that you got?
Oh, yeah, and the Synchro is lazy into fifth.
Right.
And I've been very deliberate, and it's got 8,000 miles, so I'm sure.
Does it have that rattly feel like you're running a piece of hickory through a bucket of loose marbles that kind of...
Not quite, but the Synchro, but we should qualify that. It's a media car, and I'm sure it's just been beaten to death. It's got
8,000 miles of journalist miles can be
That's like
them's a lot of miles.
Yeah. So, but it's just it's nice, but not.
We take
that
the
great.
Utmost care of those cars.
I do. But I know some others who do not. Hey, we also got word officially Ford's killing off Mercury. Peter, what do you make of this?
I think it's a good move because the other half of that story is they're all going all in on Lincoln, and they are recommitting to Lincoln, and they know they have a long way to go, but I think this is really good news for car enthusiasts because they know what they want to do with Lincoln, and it'll be interesting to watch.
Yeah, I think it'll be more than
because here's what they have as an example. They've had Cadillac, but more importantly, they have Audi. You know, Audi set about to reinvent themselves 10 years ago. And look where they are. And Cadillac, you know, Cadillac did a pretty damn good job. And, you know, they've spent $7 billion in 10 years, but they did a great job, I think, overall. So, they're setting about to do a No More Excuses Lincoln, and that's the story. Mercury, they had to do it.
They did, but how much money was really going into Mercury that's now going to be lavished on Lincoln so that we're going to see this big...
Well, it's not whatever was going into Mercury is not going to go on Lincoln. They're going to ramp up. They're going to have to spend a lot of money on Lincoln.
And
they're going to.
Right.
Their sales were down.
A good point, David. There wasn't a huge engineering budget associated with Mercury. You know, you did front and rear fascias and a few other trim and ornamentation kind of things, so it wasn't a big bill. But they did throw a lot of marketing and advertising resources at Mercury. That can all go to Lincoln right now.
How many Mercury ads did you see on national television?
I saw a lot, actually. You just don't watch the right programs.
I must
you have
be
to
watching...
watch programs for old people.
I was going to say, I'm obviously hipper than you are because I don't see any Mercury ads.
David only gets spot TV, so there's a difference.
Well, Derek Cusack said they're going to get, what, six new models in the next four? Six new or refreshed models in the next 4 years.
Well, I've seen some of their advanced design stuff, and I got to tell you, it's knee-knocking good.
No kidding.
Yeah, really.
Well, that's good to hear because Lincoln is at the bottom of the list of all the luxury brands.
And they know that. They don't have any illusions about
it. It's way under Audi and Infiniti and Acura. And I'm not disparaging them. I'm just saying they don't sell a whole lot, not compared to Mercedes and Lexus and BMW. Yeah.
But at least they know that they have a long way to go. They don't have any illusions. But I think Lincoln deserves a makeover in it.
What's the brand image going to be for Lincoln? I have no idea what Lincoln stands for.
Well, that's
a good question.
That's on the table there.
Well, they're going to have to define it with the product, not with an advertising slogan,
right.
I think.
Oh, yeah. No, this is show us the money.
Well, as we talked about here, Lincoln's made huge strides in the last couple of years, but it's like mainly cleaning up a lot of problems. The cars are better. Some of the front ends, I think, are kind of intriguing. I kind of like the headlight and grill treatment that they've done.
I don't think they're as bad off as when Cadillac embarked on their, rejuvenation. I don't think Lincoln, as at least design and technology-wise, they're not as bad as. Remember, when Cadillac started, they were still in the land of Landau roofs.
Right.
And so Lincoln's not that far not that bad. But
Lincoln's product is further along.
But they're Cadillac, off the radar screen. I mean, Lincoln's
right.
off
Cadillac's
the radar screen.
Cadillac had an iconic brand that, frankly, had more resonance than it deserved. They also, remember, when Cadillac really embarked on the first $4.3 billion, which was the Lansing plant, that rear drive platform for the CTS, the SRX, and the STS, and that's really what that money was for, most of it, they did have the Escalade, which caught on with athletes and rappers and hip-hoppers, and you had Kid Rock wearing the big Cadillac chain.
But remember, they never marketed it to those people. They
Correct.
Never advertised
and
it
there was
for
also,
those
I
people.
I did a cover story on this when the CTS first came out, and I can't remember whether it was 02 or 03, but there was this whole scene of young kids who were buying 60s caddies in Huntington Beach and Venice Beach for a couple thousand bucks, painting them wild colors. In fact, we had... And they were all in their 20s, early 20s, these kids. We had this, two-page spread. The copy was all along the bottom half of it. And there's this, 20-something girl who laid across the roof of her, 67 Eldorado for us. And it was painted this wild orange, it was a metallic orange that Ford had for the Explorer back then. And she bought the paint and put it on there. And that's what the young kids were doing. So it had this resonance with young people that I'm not sure Lincoln has.
Right.
I think in terms of brand, Cadillac has more going for it than back then than Lincoln does now. Certainly the product's further along because Cadillac, until the CTS, other than Escalade, until the CTS came out, they were old man boats. That was the Boca Raton set.
No, you're absolutely right.
But the other thing is they've got a blank canvas. They can create anything they want, and that's why it's going to be fascinating to watch because I think...
To me, the more fascinating thing will be, and I asked them yesterday, I asked Mark Fields, okay, you're talking about making this brand world class. To me, that means you got to sell it in the world, not just North America. And they were like, okay, whoa, slow down. First, we got to get it fixed here in North America. Then we'll see what happens. Well, that tells me they have talked about they got to take this brand and start selling it around the world, which would make all the sense in the world to me for Ford dealers around the world to have a luxury brand, a meaningful luxury brand to sell. That would really be something for the
Ford
company.
Ford has two issues long-term besides the debt. One is a real luxury strategy, not just here but globally, and then the other is the global strategy because they are behind in Asia and they're behind in India. And India is new enough where they can get in the game really quickly because it's still a very new market for most car makers, but way behind in China. GM has a better global story than Ford does.
No question about it. And, you can lay that in the lap.
Not by much, because Cadillac is nowhere. Cadillac's actually in China, And as a brand, has some establishment there, but nowhere in Europe. They've had more fits and starts in Europe.
Well, they won't do a diesel engine. That wipes you out of 75% of the luxury market
in
Europe.
They were in Le Mans a few years ago.
They what?
They went to Le Mans a few years ago, even though they had nothing.
Yeah, well, don't get me started on that pitiful effort that they tried there. Hey, one more news story I think that I found very interesting. Caterpillar getting into locomotives. They bought the Electromotive, which used to be part of General Motors. And remember, back in the 30s and 40s, even 50s, GM design staff worked on those locomotives.
They came
out with some really cool-looking designs. And I just find it very interesting that that Cat's getting into this business.
Yeah, I do, too. I don't know what to say about it other than someone really digs trains down there.
Woo-hoo.
Well, I think Cat's looking at it twofold. Number one, another place where they can sell their diesel engines. And Cat's very good at service and logistical work, parts logistics. They make a lot of money off that. And I got to believe they're really eyeing China and India.
Oh, yeah.
And know that there's a possibility a bunch of locomotives could get sold there. But because it's used to be part of GM and it's all transportation, I think that's fair game to talk about on this show.
It also, in terms of our audience, just hits the 75-plus model railroader part of the audience right between the eyes. They love that stuff.
Yeah, all those types that watch those Mercury ads, right? I know where you're going.
That's right.
That.
They all drive Mercuries, every one of them.
Grand Marquis. Hey, let's bring our guest on for the day. John, come on in here.
The last Mercury ad I remember on TV is the one where the woman is on the witness stand and she was up all night with the Grand Marquis, and then they got this French Grand Marquis guy sitting in the courtroom raising his eyebrows. I don't know what car it was for. I don't think it really showed you one, but that's the last Mercury ad I remember.
Yeah, I'm so old, I don't remember that one.
I did see a lot of Mercury print ads, so I must read some geeky magazines.
You must. Well, John DiCicco is with us, and John, I knew you when you were with Environmental Defense.
That's right.
And now you're a senior lecturer at the University of Michigan.
Yeah.
And what does that mean?
The ivory tower.
What does a senior lecturer mean?
Well, senior, I guess, is the gray in the beard.
But you're teaching.
But I'm teaching, yes.
And teaching what?
I'm teaching. I just finished the winter term, January through the
end
of April.
I mean, what topics are you
teaching? Oh, I know. And I taught a new course called Transportation Energy Policy. I developed it. They wanted me to do that. And it was a lot of fun. It was a lot of work. Gave me a chance to learn some of the history on the issue, as well as the day-to-day type stuff that I've been involved in for the past 20 years. So it was fun to teach it. Got a lot of really interesting questions from the students.
I was reading something that you had mentioned that I thought was pretty interesting, that policymakers know how to write all kinds of regulations for cars. They know how to do cars, but they don't know how to do oil.
Yeah, yeah.
And, with this massive gusher in the Gulf where oil's spewing all over the place, as a country, our reaction seems to be, oh, we need to have cars get better fuel economy. That'll fix it all. And to me, it just seems like madness. But as an environmentalist, I don't know how you come at the whole story.
Well, I'm really struck. That quip there, policymakers know how to do cars, but they don't seem to know how to do oil in terms of regulation. I said it at the SAE World Congress at a panel last month. And as I've worked on this issue, and I've been involved in car regulation for a good part of my career, CAFE, sort of evil word, but people have finally gotten used to again a little bit, is that while we've been regulating cars in all sorts of ways for a lot of years, and yeah, we've taken the lead out of the fuel, that was a fight, taken the sulfur out of the fuel, so the gasoline's a little cleaner now, which makes
diesel.
A big difference for the air, and the diesel. The oil industry, it's drill, baby, drill, without limit. And here now we've got a gusher sitting in the bottom of the Gulf of Mexico that they don't know how to plug. And I guess, I don't know if you guys picked up the news today, they went in there with a big set of hydraulic shears and chopped it down a little so they could try to put some other kind of containment dome over it again. but I think it's a metaphor for, you know, all this talk of, you know, getting off of oil, and that talk's been going on for, what, 30-plus years? We've got a gusher at the bottom of the Gulf. And, you know, what did the president do a few weeks before that happened? Is he was trying to cultivate energy policy support across the aisle. He said, well, let's open up some more offshore drilling.
Well, he's not saying that today.
Well, they're still restricted, but they just permitted a new nearshore well recently, actually. I think that was announced yesterday's news.
Do you see any difference between the two parties in this country when it comes to energy policy?
Not really. I don't think it's a partisan issue, really. I mean, you have some things that shake out that way, but, you know, the oil industry is something that has established itself for 100 years. You know, we need the stuff.
we do need it, right?
And I don't think that we've come to grips with that in spite of all the talk.
Well, we need it, and we've come to grips with that we need it.
Yeah, yeah.
But we haven't come to grips, I don't think, with, you know, how to reduce our dependence on it. I personally don't think CAFE is very effective. I've always said that CAFE is the slowest, most expensive, least effective way of trying to reduce our dependence on oil.
It's a mitigator. It's not
exactly
the problem. I think that's
a good way to look at it, is it? You make cars more efficient, it slows down the rate at which you consume the energy. But if you've got a more fundamental problem with the energy and the impacts that it causes, I mean, I don't think there's any reason to have anything against energy. It's the problems, you know, associated with it. You know, on the environmental side, you know, global warming. On the economic side or security side, I mean, people don't like to talk about it, but, you know, why the heck are we in the Middle East? You know, it's oil and it's history, and it goes back 100 years, that special relationship that petroleum has strategically with politics. As, you know, I dusted off in my course, and I think you as a fan of military history probably know at least as much about this as I do. You know, I really trace the way we think about oil to Churchill converting the British fleet battleships from coal to oil before
circa 1910, 1908, 1910, thereabouts.
Yeah, just before he started the process. And I think my recollection, again, from reading it, I wasn't around then, was it was not very long before World War I that he decided to make that switch, to give up homegrown, home-dug British coal for foreign oil. And he was convinced because some of the admirals said, what oil can do for us in a sea battle is speed. Logistical superiority, speed, convenience of a liquid fuel. You know.
Right.
You know, and we haven't, you know.
It was more energy and
liquid fuels are beautiful.
They can go farther, faster, and refuel more quickly.
You know. Good for battleships. It's good for making cars go fast.
I'll see a store in a tank and turn on the spigot instead of a bunch of limeys below deck shoving into the furnace.
That's right. Yes.
Right. But how do we get off this stuff, or how do we reduce our dependence on it? I mean, you know, we've talked on this show a lot. Electric cars, I don't know. You know, hydrogen, probably not in my career, maybe in my lifetime, but probably not my career. I don't know.
I'd be curious to hear actually what you think about hydrogen, because my theory on hydrogen fuel cell cars is that it's a really expensive and poor way of storing electricity on board. If you only have hydrogen fuel cells that are stationary to generate electricity to charge the cars, fine. But to put this whole chemical plant on board and then either have to cryogenically store the hydrogen in tanks or in a solid substrate of some kind that's technologically difficult, and then heat the thing up to get the hydrogen out of it, I mean, this seems like much ado to simply power an electric car because they're electric motors. I mean, do you disagree?
I don't disagree. I mean, hydrogen in a fuel cell works beautifully. I mean, I don't know if any of you guys have driven like Honda's FCX Clarity, their fuel cell car. It's really nice compared to, I remember driving some of the Ford and GM prototypes 10 years ago, and this is, it runs great. But like you said, the stuff is inconvenient, is the way to put it, in terms of storage, moving it around, safety, that sort of thing. It's, you know, barring some kind of a breakthrough that lets them store hydrogen as conveniently as we store energy and gasoline and diesel, I think it's going to be really tough.
Okay. T. Boone Pickens is talking all about natural gas. What's your read on that?
Well, you know, I think it's a little bit out of the frying pan and into the fire. You know, especially from an environmental point of view, yeah, natural gas is less carbon than oil, but it's still a fossil fuel.
But it's significantly less, isn't it? I mean, Honda claims that it's natural gas. Civic is one of the cleanest cars out there.
It absolutely is. But, you know, you can still make gasoline cars more efficient. And the benefit with natural gas has a downside, and that's methane, very potent greenhouse gas. So, I mean, start using more gas, putting it in hands of consumers in a filling up in that kind of stage, how's it going to come out? It's not going to be a huge benefit on global warming. And, again, on energy security, if we use so much oil for transportation fuel, you know, we would start to have a problem around gas. I mean, they've discovered a bunch of gas now in this, I guess it's the Marcellus Shale, I think they call it, tight gas.
And there's
shale
another
gas.
One, there's big some find under the city of Fort Worth, the Barnett Shale.
That was the original tight gas for, they proved out the technologies that they're now using in the Appalachians in the Barnett Shale.
Apparently there's a fair amount in the Rockies, too.
Yeah, no, you can find it. So, but, you know, that opens up a whole other set of problems, which people are complaining about.
I've heard is if you just replace oil use with natural gas use, then we start to see the same price and scarcity issues come
that's
up.
That's what I'm saying.
Which we don't have now.
That's what I'm saying. I mean, transportation demand is so huge that if you try to satisfy that with natural gas, which is already very important for power generation, industrial uses, home furnaces, you know, it just it doesn't make sense.
What's your take on ethanol? John's a huge supporter.
Yeah, I'm a supporter of ethanol.
I think in this form, you can't argue with it.
In a beer bottle and alcohol in some consumable way, huh?
Well, there's a kind of guy you might want to have in the show sometime, an ethanol researcher up at MSU.
Bruce Dale.
Bruce Dale.
We've had him on, not this show, we've had him on Autoline Detroit before.
Okay, though. Great.
Yeah.
And, you know, he's been working on how do you kind of crack the nut of breaking cellulosic materials down into ethanol. And he wrote a great article last year in Scientific American with a fellow researcher who works on the stuff from another angle. His name is Huber, I forget his first name, from Massachusetts. And the title of the article was Grassoline. I thought that was a really cute title.
Yeah.
But it was also a really telling title because I think if they crack the nut in terms of cellulosic conversion, meaning taking cellulose-type materials as opposed to starch and sugar, which are scarce and expensive compared to fibers and wastes and things you could do. They crack the nut on breaking that down into small molecules. They're not that much far from building those into very convenient larger molecules that could go into gasoline and diesel. So that's where the title of this Grassoline came from. So it's not clear to me that the ethanol per se is any more than
a stepping stone.
Short-term type of thing. And, you know, frankly, you know, the agricultural interests like it because it's, I mean, let's be frank, it's why do we have it largely? Because it's a way of expanding agricultural subsidies.
Mm-hmm.
So getting it beyond you know, a niche that sort of satisfies the agricultural producers to really make a dent, I think, is going to mean taking the biomass or whatever it is, algae people talk about, and converting it into what the oilies would call fully fungible fuels, meaning stuff you can put right into gasoline and diesel fuel without limit. Same types of brews of molecules that are now great in terms of mobility.
So you seem to be saying that the only thing that we can really do right now is, at least on the car side of things, is just make the internal combustion engine a lot more efficient.
On the car side, I think, yeah. I mean, efficiency is important. I want to go back to the question about, well, what are we going to do to get off of oil? Because we sort of, you know, went down the list. We didn't spend a lot of time on EVs. I know you're not going to find me being an EV booster. And, you know, we had hydrogen. We just talked about ethanol. We talked about natural gas. I think as long as we as a country keep asking the question that way, what are we going to use to replace oil? I mean, we've been asking that question for, what, nearly 40 years in that way. We're going to keep drawing a blank or coming up with partial solutions. I think what I take away from, you know, the story of the Gulf, because it's putting on the public radar screen just to what extent we as a world are using technology to get at oil. I mean, if you're worried about peak oil happening soon, I point to a gusher at the bottom of the Gulf of Mexico and say, you know, where's the peak oil? That's more expensive to do, but that's going on all around the world. And when I can pull myself away from automotive news as a sort of a weekly thing, I occasionally pull out the Oil and Gas Journal. And every summer, the Oil and Gas Journal does a a survey article of production exploration, you know, for the year, what's been put in place. And it was not this last summer, but the summer before, I tallied up the numbers. They published these pages of tables, kind of like, you know, Automotive News or Ward's does in terms of car production. They put in, okay, where are the oil wells being put in and how much and what's their expected production? And my recollection is something like 22 to 23 million barrels a day of new production was slated to be coming online. And this is projects where the investments are being made. This is not speculative stuff. It's projects that are in the pipeline, literally. 22 to 23 more million barrels a day were expected to come online from this year through, you know, the next 5 years or so.
Which is a lot.
Which is a lot. The world consumption is just around 90, maybe less than 90 with the economy down. Now, mind you, old wells are depleting, and the peak oil people like to point to those depleting wells. But, you know, there's lots of stuff out there at cost. And it's not cheap to do what BP does when it works, and, you know, when it works well. And that's going on, deep offshore is going on all around the world. Actually, huge effort. You know, we think of Brazil as the home of ethanol. Petrobras, the Brazilian oil company, is one of the world leaders in deep offshore oil production. So
you don't buy the whole peak oil thing. You're saying there's plenty of oil out there.
At a price. You know, if we said we were only going to pay what we were paying, you know, say before 9/11, what, $20-some dollars a barrel, and that's all we would ever pay, then, yeah, sure, we'd hit a peak.
No, but you're right. There are a lot of sources out there, including Iraq, that are, for what people want, underutilized.
Yeah, underutilized. We'll, and then at $70 a barrel, you're getting into deep offshore tar sands, taking remote gas that's hard to bring to market, gas to liquids. There's a whole set of unconventional fossil resources that the oil and gas industry, at a cost, knows how to convert into really nice fuel.
And you know what? Even at $100 a barrel, which the translation to gasoline prices is not such a hard and fast calculation to do, but at $100 a barrel, say that's $3-something a gallon, that doesn't, unless it gets closer to four, doesn't really change our buy. It changed our buying habits 2 years ago, but not as radically as we thought. Yeah. Or at least it did in the first couple of months, and then we sort of started getting back to normal, even though prices were above $4. And it really shows you that American consumers, more so than anybody, will keep using this stuff.
That's right.
Even at significantly higher prices.
So where I go, I think saying, what are we going to use to replace oil? How are we going to get oil independent? As long as we keep asking that question, we're going to be barking up the wrong tree. I think we have to say oil, the fossil endowment, stuff that can be converted into oil-like fuels at a cost, is here. It's going to be with us. We don't have any handy replacements for mobility, for whether it's automobiles, battleships, or airplanes. And so let's have a conversation about how we manage those impacts, how we manage the downsides of that. Are we going to handle this in a way that we have to be at perpetual war to secure access to it? Are we going to manage it in such a way that we're going to have out-of-control gushers popping up in inconvenient places that are hard to contain? And then from a, you know, on the other side of the environmental spectrum, are we going to manage it in such a way where, you know, there's no limit to the amount of net carbon that comes up into the atmosphere from it? So I think if we start having a conversation that says, look, oil is here, it's going to be with us for a long time in some way, shape, or form, how do we manage the impacts so that its downsides don't grab us and create the kinds of problems they have? I think that's a more intelligent conversation to have.
Very interesting way of looking at it.
Then what's going to replace it?
Very interesting way of looking at it. And that's not in the public debate.
You think it's just use less of it?
Well, I think using less of it, that's where the efficiency comes in. That's, you know, so, and that's part of the managing it that we have some policies in place for, you know, but they're incomplete.
Now, you're saying earlier you don't think electric cars are the answer. Did I hear you right or maybe not?
I think it's the wrong question. If you say, what's going to replace oil, I'm not going to, you know, buy into that question and say either electric cars or not. I think in many ways, if you think about, you know, where the automobile is going, I mean, we're talking about, you know, the conversation before you guys had was, you know, Lincoln, brands, what's going on today. Where is the car headed in a world of megacities, in a world of a next generation growing up with information technology? And I think we've chatted about this before. I think more and more of the value of the car is going to be in its connectivity. You know, for a lot of people, maybe heresy here in greater Motown, people would rather not drive. It doesn't mean they wouldn't want to have a personal automobile. They would be very happy if it drove itself. Thank you. So I think if you begin disconnecting what the car means from the traditional, what now traditional and established car, and get into a personal mobility appliance that's connected to the world and perhaps drives itself and offers lots of other features, as well as that personal sense of security. It's my car, because that's the what makes it work financially. That's different than mass transit. You will find a better fit for electricity. Right now, the electric car, you know, you're trying to put a battery into something that largely is expected to run on an infrastructure and have expectations fairly similar to a liquid-fueled car, and it's just tough. But if you reconceive the car, you know, as I think will happen with information technology, then I think electrification starts to make more sense. But that's, you know, that's far out stuff. But
not that far out.
But you know,
we're talking another decade, maybe.
I don't think so. It doesn't require the kinds of breakthroughs that it would take to get a lithium battery to last a full lifetime, or it doesn't take certainly the kinds of breakthroughs it would take to get a hydrogen car running, because it's just rethinking how we use what we've got.
Yeah. No. All I was saying is full autonomous cars, the interconnectivity that you're talking about. We're talking about 2020. We're going to start seeing that.
I think so. And I think I think that's going to be more transformative and have a potentially greater impact on the energy situation than all this struggling about, is it this fuel or that fuel?
Sure, because right now, essentially, I'll just use the United States as an example. Every morning, the United States wakes up and it throws 250 million vehicles on the road and says, we'll put some stop signs and traffic lights out there, but you all figure it out. So we don't address it as a system.
Right.
Unlike, say, like the air transport system or even a subway system.
Well, protect us from the air transport analogy.
Okay, but all I'm getting at, I hear you. As somebody who just hates flying to travel these days, not because I'm afraid of flying, it's just the whole mess of it. But if we start having interconnectivity in vehicles, we just ran a thing on Autoline Daily today. See, I do remember this part of the show. Where Audi has looked at, boy, if you could only have intelligent semaphores, traffic lights, you can get something like, what was it, a 17 or 18% improvement in fuel economy, just so that if you time it right, you get to the light just as it turns green. You never slow down.
That's
you never speed up.
That's right.
And guess what? Who likes stopping at traffic lights? Nobody likes that. Or what we're just running on the screen there, or were right now, are the autonomous cars that DARPA had at their competition.
Right. They've been demonstrating those.
And as I love talking about, you know, we got to get somebody from Audi in here, too. We got to get you on. Yeah, absolutely take the driving out.
I think 21st century.
Not for everybody.
Not
all the time. But I don't know anybody who wants to be in stop and
go. Most 21st century world citizens are going to be too good to drive. They've got better things to do with their time, especially in, if you think about most people living in highly congested, dense megacities.
Right. Stop and go traffic.
You would rather
no fun
be
driving
in, you'd rather, you want a personal space that's virtually connected. You want the security.
You've got people texting and surfing the web in their
We'll let them do that without crashing into each other.
You're talking about when you go into urban centers. That you'll have the system in your car, and you'll have your destination plugged in, and it'll take over.
Yeah,
right.
You give it.
But when you want to get out on the open road and let it rip, you turn off the autonomous driving.
You know, a lot of people, next generation,
sounds
in a lot
like
of places aren't growing up with
good.
A sense of the open road. You know, that's just not going to be.
It's like it's going nowhere good. They're gonna have to pry my cold dead hands off my steering wheel.
Yeah. Now, here's another heresy quip for you guys. I think as we go 20, 30 years down the road, something I hope all of us live to see, we'll see the beginning of horsepower going the way of the horse. And what I mean by that is there'll be, just like there's always, there's horse races and tracks and it's passionate aficionados. I think car racing and the performance and all of that, will have its aficionados, but it will be so out of touch with the reality of what people need personal mobility for that we'll see it becoming a niche as opposed to a dominant paradigm.
I'll be dead then, fortunately.
But that's got to be
Think about the possibilities if you're liberated from having to drive in terms of what you can do in your automobile.
Well, no, it opens up the automobile to a lot more of society.
But we have young been moving this way. I mean, you have people buying family sedans like Nissan Altimas with 260 horsepower, stuff like that. So even cars that should be commodities just to get point A to point B have been amping up the horsepower for a decade now.
Yeah, but what do most people do with that?
Well,
they pass people.
it's like so many other things that we buy. It's not like we're screaming from stoplight to stoplight or racing around town every single day, but
it's good to know we can.
Good to know we can, and there's times where you're on the open road, and it's like I want to push this thing.
That's a cultural thing that very real. It's a dominant paradigm, but is it going to serve the needs of a pierced and wired generation for whom, gigahertz bandwidth is more meaningful than horsepower and RPM?
But what could usher this in is traffic in cities is getting worse. So it's not as fun to drive, and you're spending more time commuting, which is wasted time. I love my satellite radio and my iPod, but you get tired of being in the car when you have work to do, whatever. And
that could usher it in if traffic gets dense enough in the big cities where it's just commuting isn't fun, it's a waste of time.
And we don't see it as much in this country as you do in the developing
world. Yeah, I don't think we're going to see it here. I mean, have you guys heard about this experiment that I think it's called CASE, the Korean Advanced Institute of Science and Technology. I think it's like the Korean version of MIT. They have a former president of Hyundai involved, and they are demonstrating and developing essentially autonomous vehicles running on inductive strips, so they don't need a lot of battery. You guys have probably heard about taking the mm-hmm. power from the roadway. So you've essentially got a rethought infrastructure. I would call it a intelligent, energized infrastructure that the vehicles are running on. And they've got some, I think, buses running this way. And what I've read, there's been a few news stories on it, and I've gone to the university website, and they have some English about it, is that they're going to take an island that's like a vacation island off of Korea and convert it to vehicles, based on this intelligent inductive charging control.
Oh, yeah. No, that's been talked about for a quarter of a century.
GM talked about it at the Motorama in the 50s.
Right. Oh, absolutely. Yeah. No, I know it's been talked, but here I'm saying these people are serious.
Yeah, but the only problem that I've heard about it, because I did a lot of research on this going back, I don't know, 20 years ago, is now you need to put all kinds of power through the roadways, and over distances you get power degradation, which means you have to put in transformers along the way or all these other things. Not saying that it can't be done, but when I talked to everybody at the time back when, they said this is where you need superconductive material so that you can get that electricity with no loss of power over great long distances to really make that become a reality.
Well, I think you have to look at it again. If you're looking at the North American landscape and, great long distances, such as we consider ordinary distances around here, as opposed to serving multi-million populations in areas that are geographically much less area-wise than, say, Metro Detroit, it's a different problem. It's a different problem, one that's much more amenable to that kind of solution. And again, I think it comes back to, like anything else in a product is the value to the customer. And those potential customers are going to, I think, see a lot more value in a product and system like that than, say, trying to plunk a Nissan Leaf into the middle of a big city. Not that I don't hail Nissan for doing what they're doing, and I actually think they're going to find a nice niche there for something like that. It's hard for me to see that as the beginning of the car of the future, though.
Yeah.
By the way, while we were sitting here, one of my colleagues sent an email to my phone accusing you of speaking heresy in Motown.
This is the most depressing show I've ever had.
Well, I'll say
I find this exciting.
Well, I find it exciting, and I would say General Motors is actually at the forefront of autonomy technology of any car company that I've run across. I mean, some of the best stuff is being done not that far from here in Warren,
really
Michigan.
What are they doing with it, though?
They're going to do a lot. My prediction is GM will probably. If I have to have this snapshot of time, I'd say GM's the most likely to be out with an autonomous car.
So 20 years from now, you'll be sneaking out of your garage.
I think it's going to happen. I think it's going to happen more.
Yes, I will.
Because they have more of a need
flaunting the system.
Right, and also they can.
Or there'll be packs of motorcycles designed to go in excess of 150, because that'll be your last refuge of freedom.
It will be. No, there's no question.
Because otherwise, if you're not registered with the government and you don't have the chip in your head.
Right.
So before I go out, I'm going to go out taking a bunch of people with me who come out at night and go 200 miles an hour and anything they can.
No, wait a minute. I have something for Peter here. Can this show move from, I think we've been G audience. I don't even think we've crossed into PG.
Yeah.
Can I tread on R?
Sure.
We need the ratings.
Yeah, we need the we need the ratings, Peter. Imagine, virtual car. It's private space, spacious as you want it.
So you could have sex on the way into Manhattan?
Well, you're on your way, hard day in the office, hard day in front of Auto Extremist blog, and, you know, on your way home, and you sort of want to program yourself a little virtual sexual experience along the way. And, you know, again, like
check,
the
please.
Tower. along the, you know, I mean, think about, you know, what that kind of content has driven on the internet.
Nightmare. Oh, it's a nightmare. I mean, yeah, I can see what you're thinking.
So,
you know, I can see you put on my
future
glasses.
The trade-off is you can't have the joy of driving, but you can have porn on your way to work. Is it?
You can have whatever virtual experience you want.
I think it's time for rapid fire.
You know, I do too.
Ben, let's bring up that graphic.
I think I've certainly queued it up.
Who's going to have the first DJ question? That's what I want to know.
Okay, Mike DeWhite writes in and he says, the Chevy Cruze is going to start just under $17,000. Is that too high?
No.
No, I think that's competitive.
I think that's competitive.
For a C-Class car?
Yeah.
Turning at 15?
It's just under 17.
I think that's fine.
Now, that's the base. And then it jumps up $2,000 for the next level. And then I think another $3,000 on top of that.
I think that's fine because, you know, we're talking a highly contented vehicle that delivers, you know, really tremendous mileage. I think it's fine.
I don't know. That's a big plant. They got to sell out that plant. We'll see.
Okay.
I'm skeptical of all of these compact cars that are going to sell for $20,000 a pop. We'll see.
John Wills wants to know, what's that small Lincoln car going to look like, and is it going to cost under $30,000? This is Ford saying they're going to come out with a C-Class.
Well, that Concept Lincoln. C was a concept. Mm-hmm. That was a Freeman Thomas concept, and I happen to think Freeman is the top three designers in the world. And if you spent some time with that car, it was really quite good. But will a C-Class Lincoln look like that? No, it won't look like that. But they learned a lot by doing that.
Under $30,000?
No.
I don't think it should be.
No,
if it's a Lincoln,
I
don't think it should be under
Lincoln, it should be $35,000 minimum.
Unsprung wants to know, can a standalone Lincoln dealer make it?
If they redo the brand the way I think they're going to do, the Lincoln franchise will be a very desirable franchise to have.
But not just yet.
Not just yet, no.
Well, any dealer can make it with the right location, the right rent factor, and a good repair business. I mean,
they got to have the products, though.
Joseph wants to know, John, what do you think of the feasibility of drilling through really thick oil beneath South America?
That's a good question. Really thick oil beneath South America.
Yeah.
I'm not familiar with that. I do know that in Venezuela, they basically have some pretty thick oil.
And Brazil's found a lot of deep water stuff that's extremely thick, too.
Yeah.
What is it, like Jell-O?
Probably. Yeah, probably.
Jed, move away from there.
Yeah. It won't gush as well, I guess. Yeah. There's maybe some advantages.
It'll just sink to the bottom.
Could Peter comment on what he thinks of the latest Kia Soul hamster ad? And what does the panel think of Kia's total overhaul of their styling?
I haven't seen the latest hamster.
You know, darn it, I've got that. I don't have it ready queued up. We'll have to get that on next week's show, maybe.
Okay.
It's sort of a hip-hop kind of very urban scene. What do you think of Kia's styling overall?
I like the Soul. The rest of the stuff leaves me cold.
See, I kind of like it. Peter Schreier is doing their stuff, and I think it happens to look pretty good.
Definitely looks better than it did.
Yeah.
Actually, the new Santa Fe looks pretty good, too. I'll say that.
What about the coupe?
And the coupe, I think, looks pretty good.
Yeah.
I think everything
I
coming
like
out
of... I do like the Soul quite a bit. I think that's really cool, actually.
Okay, PT wants to know, John, what do you think of the large hole in the ozone over Australia? Oh, do we know why the large hole in the ozone over Australia exists? Is there one?
Another stumper. I hadn't heard of a particular hole over Australia.
I've heard it over Antarctica.
Antarctic, yeah. Due to ozone-eating chemicals.
All the Barbies.
But that's an example. You know, that's an example of a problem that we've made headway in managing. So
too many kangaroo farts.
Yeah.
Right. George from Brooklyn wants to know, what do we think of the 2012 Dodge Charger? I haven't seen it.
I've seen hints of it. It's going to be very much reminiscent of the great-looking Charger from way back.
68, which is a terrific-looking car.
If they pull it off, it'll be cool.
It'll be better than the rather garish one that's out now. Both of those cars, the Charger and the 300, are a lot more tastefully done.
The Charger is the coolest police car ever in black. But I expect great things for the new Charger.
Jay Cujo wants to know, is Lincoln going down market a good idea if they're supposed to be taking on Cadillac, Lexus, et cetera? Well, yeah, I think it's smart for, if by down market you mean coming out with a C-Class car, I think it's inevitable. You're going to see, in Europe, you see Mercedes with a B-Class car, an A-Class car.
Don't expect the new C-Class Lincoln to be the design signature for the brand going forward. They will have other things out before they bring a C-Class Lincoln out.
Plus, you look at luxury brands that come back or come on a resurgence. When Audi came out of the whole sudden acceleration mess, they cut the price on their cars. They were selling $5,000 less than a competing BMW. The real key to the first generation Cadillac CTS was that it was the size and performance of a 5 Series. But the average transaction price was $35,000, which was the price of a cheap 3, because the average transaction price on a 3 Series was $38,000. So when you're coming back as a luxury brand, you have to charge luxury prices so people believe you're luxury, but you have to offer value compared to the top dogs.
And luxury is also, you see the luxury brands also reaching down. They know they need to have smaller vehicles.
Well, they have to, if only for fuel economy reasons, to meet the letter of the law. They need to balance that out. So they're going to.
Well, the idea of a small vehicle, as you see, like you talked about the Cruze, you can't have a really competitive small vehicle in this market now unless it's got good content, so that it's not, this Econobox thing anymore. And so I think there's a lot of room for, luxury marquees to have something that's got a premium distinctiveness in those classes. They're going to have to compete there.
Even Aston Martin's doing what's that called, the Signet?
Yeah.
Their version of the Toyota
IQ? But they only sell it to their owners.
Is that right?
Yes. Just something to run into town with.
Hey, we ought to bring in some phone calls here. We have, Ben, let's bring in a phone call because we always have a number of people calling in here.
Hey, guys, this is Jeff W. from Albany, New York. Everyone agrees that the new Jeep Grand Cherokee has to be a hit for Chrysler. I was just kind of curious, how many units per year do they need to sell for, how many units do they need to sell a year in order to be considered a success? And, the second part to that question is, should unemployment in the U.S. remain relatively high, how likely are they going to be able to hit that number for a vehicle at that relatively, high price point? Thanks. Talk to you later.
I asked that question when they rolled the Grand Cherokee out at the plant, and they wouldn't answer it. Wouldn't talk about capacity or anything, so I don't know what they need to sell. Should unemployment remain high, we're going to continue with these really great 11.6 million unit SARs that John keeps crowing about and ambling and crawling our way out of the recession. I believe the guy in Albany was the same one who asked the Opel question last week, by the way, which was a really good question, because one thing we forgot to talk about is that the German government is really balking at giving GM the money.
Yeah. And I told you last week, I didn't think they were going to get
it. I was wrong on that, because I thought once the German labor union sign on, and let's face it, Germany is sort of one big trade union, that once labor was on board, then the government would be too, but they don't want to do it. GM will come up with the money. What I think that means, and this was another part of his question last week, as I recall, is that GM will still have these three German plants for now. In the future, they'll be less beholden to the German government and to Germany, and I could see them taking down a plant like Eisenach and adding third shifts on in Spain and the UK and Poland and just say, okay, because all three of those countries are cheaper to produce in than Germany. So That's an interesting drama that we didn't talk much about, but is going to unfold. And I think over a period of time, you'll see this happen. And GM needs to do it anyway.
So what do you think, John? What do you think they need to sell the Grand Cherokee?
I'd say Jefferson North, I don't know off the top of my head, it's probably capacitized for about $240,000 a year.
There's going to be a Durango replacement.
There's going to be
there,
a Durango there,
vehicle,
too.
And we don't know what they are, so we don't know what right. you could expect anything. There's too many variables.
But I would say, 2 years in, because they're going to have to build everything back up and all, I'd say 140,000, 150,000 Grand Cherokees.
That's a lot.
Mm-hmm. But I'm telling you, I think that's where they're going to have to settle in.
I think they're going to come in at about 80.
If I had to pull a number just out of the air, I'd say 80 to 100 is probably what they're expecting, because I think these other vehicles are going to be on the hook for more.
I think
they added a second shift there, though, so they've got expectations for something.
I think they'll do 60 to 80 in the first year, and then I think they got to ramp that thing up to 150 to really hit the numbers that they need to get.
Good luck.
Well, that's a problem.
Jim Schultz says, please tell Peter I thoroughly enjoyed reading his commencement address piece this week on the website. Great job.
Thank you.
And I'm looking for one. I know we got a letter in here because last week we were talking about, here it is, from George Wolford from Belgium, who says, enjoyed the show this week, have watched them all. One correction, the XR4 Ti was a Sierra, not a Granada, because last week we talked about, I think I might have been the one who said, wasn't that a Granada?
I didn't know what it was. I was just fawning over the
yeah. He said the Granada was replaced by the Scorpio, although in Britain it was called the Granada for a while, and the Granada, ergo, or, Nia Scorpio came here as the Mercur Scorpio. But I love the fact that we've got George Wolford from Belgium correcting us on that one. And
every car has a fan.
That's right. Let's bring in one of those other phone callers that we got there, Ben. Let's bring that in now.
Hey, guys. It's Eric, a.k.a. Rumblescript. And a question for the crew tonight is, how much of Elon Musk's quote-unquote cash flow issues are legit, and how much of it are him trying to hide money because he's getting divorced? Thanks, guys.
Well, he is getting divorced.
As his soon-to-be ex-wife blogs about daily on her own webpage. You gotta love Elon Musk, because he fires executives left and right. He goes out, and remember last year, we made a profit in July because everyone was accusing the company of not making any money, and he said, see, we're profitable for the month of July. Now, everyone knows car companies can, shift marketing product programs a month or even several quarters to make the numbers look good. And then you see their S-1 for their IPO, and they've never made any money. He's a salesman type. He does have some great technology in some ways. He's kind of this mad genius. Now he's got this public divorce. This guy is a character. He's a great story.
So, yeah, he's burying something.
Yeah.
Does he have a personal relationship with a banker in Bermuda? I don't know, but it's a good question. His soon-to-be ex, Justine, might want to tee up.
Andre Vieira wants to know, is Ford making a mistake with the Ford Taurus police cruiser package instead of staying with the Crown Victoria?
They'll make it work. Short of them doing an all-new rear-wheel drive chassis in this day and age, which is highly unlikely, it's going to be all-wheel drive or front-wheel drive. I mean, I think they'll make it work. I think, GM might make some headway. With that G8 based Impala and Chrysler, like I said, they make a great-looking police car.
Yeah, I don't think Ford's going to have quite the lock, on that market.
But they have a lot of loyalty out there.
A lot of loyalty, but the loyalty has been because everybody has all the tools and all the parts. They know how to take Crown Vics apart in their sleep.
Yeah, and that's over with, right?
And that's over with, right. So now it sort of resets it for everyone. But I think it's smart for Ford to do this. They couldn't hold on to the Crown Vic forever. Maybe they can get some more sales for the Taurus. So it kind of makes sense. We've got one, and maybe we'll make this the last one. Jim Campbell asks, how come there's not more studies around the total CO2 for the production of nickel for batteries, the CO2 for tankers that ship the oil from the Middle East? And I'm trying to paraphrase this. He lives in Calgary, where the tar sands are criticized for being dirty oil. I'm not sure. Maybe he's getting to. Don't we have to look at more of a well to wheels kind of comparison?
Right. Well to wheels, cradle to grave. And that information's out there. That was the kind of study that I think you guys mentioned early in the show, the one from Argonne and Xinghua that talked about how electric cars don't look so good in China. That was a wheel to
wheels. Because China uses so much coal that electric cars will actually increase pollution.
That's right. And the same. It's kind of a quasi-government laboratory called Argonne National Laboratory, publishes analyses of the impacts of batteries, and they've got analyses of the impacts of all flavors of oil. So that's been done.
Well, good. Well, this is probably a good place to wrap it up here. But, John DiCicco, it's been great having you on here. Really enjoyed having you here. And Peter, as always, and David, as always, have a great...
There you are.
Yeah. I threw them off by looking at the other and saying the other's name. Anyway, hey, before we go, want to remind everybody again, next week we're going to be coming from the Henry Ford at 6 p.m. We'll start an hour earlier. They're opening a new racing exhibit at the Henry Ford. We're hoping to get a number of people on the show who will be attending that event. The Wood Brothers are going to be there. Roger Penske's going to be there. Edsel Ford's going to be there. Jack Roush is going to be there. So could be a very interesting show. Make sure you tune in for that. Also, you can follow us on Facebook, facebook.com/OutOfLineDetroit, twitter.com/OutOfLine. You can always follow Peter at autoextremist.com, reading his stuff, or follow him at twitter.com/autoextremist. David's always at businessweek.com and bloomberg.com. And John, do you have any website or
I don't have a blog.
Or anything that
no,
you
I'm not currently active in that mode. I wasn't. No.
Good for you.
Yeah.
Twitter sucks.
And remember, you can always get things through Stitcher, but thanks, everybody, for having tuned in.
Visit our website, OutOfLineDetroit.tv, where you can watch us live Thursday nights at 7 p.m. Eastern, get your daily automotive news fix with OutOfLine Daily, and in-depth analysis and interviews with OutOfLine Detroit. That's all there, and much more, at OutOfLineDetroit.tv.
AutoLine After Hours is brought to you by Bridgestone. Passion for excellence. Change of frequency.